think I'll start. Welcome to my presentation about C++ development within OpenOffice. So this is basically about OpenOffice core programming. The core is, I think it's nearly 100% C++. A little bit of C, tiny little bit of assembler. The core, that's where the vast majority of the OpenOffice functionality and from lines of code perspective, the code is located. And if things go wrong, you pretty much need to know your way around in the core. Because most of the functionality is located there, or affects functionality located there. If you need to fix a bug, you probably need to fix a bug in the core. I was trying to kind of complement the talks of Kai Beckmann and Matthias Bauer. Still it's kind of a bag of missed stuff, what I was always wanting to tell about the way the core is designed, how we develop for the core, and maybe explain why things are as they are. Okay, so in case you don't know, OpenOffice is huge. About 5.2 million source lines of code, which is all of the source code, which also include Java and Perl scripts and makefiles and Python and all of that. But the vast majority is the C++, which is 4.6 million lines of code, which amounts to 89%. That's split up into about 23,000 files. Just for comparison, early Linux kernel version 2.6 was about 4.3 million lines of code. This is that numbers come from slug count, that basically just skips the blank lines and counts the source code lines. Down in the core, OpenOffice is just classic C++. Not too much Uno, so this is basically classes and inheritance. You have sometimes very big inheritance hierarchies, 20, 30 levels. And it's spread across a lot of shared libraries, which gives us kind of a huge and coupled beast. You've maybe attended Kai Beckmann's talk. If you build OpenOffice from scratch with the status we have now, it takes about a day under Linux.
4.5 hours.
Depends on what you deselect. Or it takes 5 to 6 hours on my machine, but I deselect a lot of stuff. Yeah, of course. Yeah, as Kai told, there are lots of things that can improve the raw build times. But there's one aspect, and I'm shortly getting to that, which is not addressed by that pure build-focused frameworks. So, yeah, I said it's coupled. What do I mean by that? Separate compilation units are highly dependent on other files, on header files. So, for example, I counted the numbers of files that directly or indirectly included the prominent header file VCL window, which is the platform window abstraction, and that's basically every third file in OpenOffice source tree, every CSX file in OpenOffice source tree, either directly or indirectly includes window HXX, which amounts to about 2,500 files. So even if you have all the build speedups that Kai was talking about, if you are the unlucky guy who need to change that header file, you still need to rebuild 1/3 of OpenOffice. So Kai was talking about that zero change build time, which you get down to about a few seconds. And one would expect to have, if you do a small change, you would only increase the build time a similar small amount. But that's not true because of that highly coupled aspect. If you change the wrong file and do a build, you end up building, yeah, well, 1/3 of OpenOffice. So that's what I mean by coupled, and that's specific to the way things have been done in C++, which is in C, you typically don't have that large dependency trees for whatever reasons. Maybe because you're not so fine-grained, you don't split things up into so many tiny aspects. But on the other hand, for C++, if you inherit from a class, you need the full class definition. That is, you must include the header file for that class. And yeah, well, that's another reason why those dependency hierarchies are so huge. Okay, so I don't think anybody wants to wait 3 hours or 2 hours or whatever larger amount of time just to recompile after the one line change in the wrong file. It's the same story Kai was telling you, is that for the novice developer, things should be easy. Things the feedback cycle should be short. So if you have global dependencies and you edit the wrong file, you end up, even if all the work with the build speedup is done, you still end up waiting for quite a long time. Yeah, that's a nice sentence. I will read it literally. In contrast to the scholarly focus on encapsulation, which is about logical dependencies. So class logically depend on another class, for example, if it inherits that class or uses that class. A large C++ project like OpenOffice also has to care about physical dependencies. And physical dependencies is that header inclusion stuff. Like, I need to include that header only because I have a private member for that class, but I still need to include header x, y, because that's the way C++ works. Even if it's private data in the class, you still need to have the full definition of that type. Another measure, the transitive closure, that is the whole dependency graph with all, if you can go from A to B and from B to C, or also the edge from A to C is included in that graph, that is direct, that I was referring to that in that phrase, directly or indirectly including a header. So this is a complete graph, so it's basically the number of nodes, which is nearly 2 million edges in that dependency graph. That's the number of dependencies that exist in OpenOffice, because if I change a header that is indirectly included, I still have to recompile the file. So that's, I think, the right measure to take here. That means about 274 dependent files per compilation unit. I did the measurement on my local copy, which excludes bin folder, so I think with bin folder included, the numbers would even be higher. because WinSort is also pretty old code. How to break that? How to break those dependencies? You probably know that OpenOffice is broken down. If you do a checkout of the OpenOffice source tree, it's broken down into high-level modules, where are simply subdirectories or directories in that checkout, checkout tree. The idea or the design or the plan behind that was to have each module provide a cohesive area of functionality. Like, for example, VCL is one module. VCL provides UI platform abstraction, or module SW provides the writer application, and so forth. So each module needs to provide a public interface to be used from other modules. I'm always referring to the C++ way of doing things. That's a different story for UNO modules, but for the moment I'm referring to that plain C++ kind of module, like VCL or Writer or ProImpress or SVX. The majority of the modules are still plain C++. But anyway, each module provides an interface via exported headers. That is, to use functionality from that module, you need to deliver a subset of the headers into a global called solver directory, which is initially empty. And while OpenOffice gets built, that solver directory gets populated by exported headers and libraries. So this kind of defines the exported interface of a module. So now, if you have a plain OpenOffice build, you have dependencies over all modules, also over the solver. You can switch off that solver dependencies by undefining that environment variable, mkdependsolver, which cuts the dependency graph at the module level. That is, for each file in each module, only header files that are within the same module are considered dependent. So it's like ignoring all changes on other modules' exported headers. If you do that, you only have intra-module dependencies, and you are down to only 42. In the mean, 42 dependent files per compilation unit. The number before was, I think, 270 something. So it's a reduction by a factor of 5. On the other hand, now you don't have automatic recompilation. If you change a header in VCL, then there's no automatism to rebuild draw or writer for that. So this leads to the concept of compatible versus incompatible changes. You need to know if you change a header in VCL and you only change commentary, then you know you don't need to recompile everything else. So that's basically that's a trade-off between the build speed or the speed of developing things and security or safety, like to be sure that your build really caught all files. And of course, it's a thing that has to be done in your head, and there's no automatism. Questions about that? Okay. The C++ way of breaking dependencies, which is also quite widely used from the open office source, is to insulate a class. I'll get to that shortly. And what it means is that changing implementation should not require anybody else to recompile. An implementation, of course, is also a private member, or adding another private method or something like that. Anyway, the first step, you can reduce, of course, reduce dependencies by using by usage of forward declarations. Instead of including header, you can forward declare the class you use, or keep enumerations at the classes by using them instead of putting them into a global enum file, because every time you change, you add a new enum or a new type, and everybody else includes that global enum file, everybody else will need to recompile, etc., etc., avoid default arguments, and so forth. True insulation, in the meaning of the word, can be achieved by using the PIMPL idiom. I'll explain what's that on the next slide, or by using the abstract interface or protocol class, which is the way UNO works. In UNO you have only interfaces, and to get an implementation for that interface, you have to call a factory to provide yourself one. So in this case, if you change the implementation, nobody will notice, no header needs to be changed, so the implementation is insulated. PIMPL looks like this. You have it's kind of the handle body idiom. You have a class which only has one opaque pointer down here. The way forward declared implementation structure, and all the functionality and all the members are contained within that class. So if you change, if you add a member, or if you change a member, or if you add new functionality, you leave that in the implementation and not in the header. So again, the clients are insulated from the changes. That's pretty heavily used. For example, ECL window, HXX, by now also uses a PIMPL pointer for the member data. Short comparison. Performance-wise, PIMPL is slightly faster because there are, at least not necessarily, there are no virtual function calls. You can implement or provide concrete classes via PIMPL, whereas if you have an abstract interface, you only have the interface, no implementation. You cannot easily derive from the implementation, whereas you can derive from a PIMPL class. On the other hand, you can create those PIMPL classes as automatic variables on the stack, which is kind of more lightweight. But protocol classes or abstract interfaces also remove lifetime dependencies. So for example, the way UNO works. So you only have a pure UNO component or a pure UNO library. Only has four C methods, gets loaded on demand, and just tells the service factory, hey, I implement this, and that service, and then during runtime, the class, the library gets loaded, and the class instantiated. Does not work in every case. If you have a frequently used objects, like for example strings, or other small objects, the overhead might be prohibitive, because every time you create such a PIMPL class, you have to have at least one heap of location in the background, and you can't provide, for example, inline methods, because inlines would again expose the internals Well, so if you have a template class and it's frequently used, then you might consider to make it copy and write, which is another trick to avoid overly generous copying and equivocations. So some other things to avoid. Avoid non-local statics, because that adds to the startup time, because all of that statics get initialized during during startup. When the library is brought into memory, all the statics get initialized. And yeah, all that other basically I think it's common stuff. It's just for completeness that I'm listing it here. You should pass user defined values by reference or by pointer to avoid copying. You should make mass objects copy and write unless they need to be thread safe. You should avoid short and float types as interfaces, because the C++ type promotion rules really thwart that perceived security. Like, you have an interface and say, okay, I only allow values between 0 and 65,000. Then I'll be safe, because all clients that put in larger values will get a message from the compiler. That's not the case, because there are type promotion rules in C++ that automatically convert an int to a short if necessary. Same for float and double. Be aware of automatic conversions, like providing default or copy constructors or default constructors for basic integer types. We used to have a integer constructor at the string. So you have a, because it happens behind your back. The compiler just tries to find a way from the value you give when calling a function and the value that's needed. And if it finds a way, it just generates a temporary plugs in a value, although in the end it was a typo from the solver. Make sure that code compiles warning free. Make sure that you be as const as you can. So provide label every method as const that from a logical perspective does not change anything at your class. Avoid exception specifications, etc. All of that, I think there's not much to add there in this book. I think it's worth reading for everyone doing C++ coding. So, yeah, from the items of the last slide, there are a few helpers that that are there to help you avoid all that pitfalls. For example, all of the nice stuff in the Boost library. For example, that scope pointer. If you have, if you need to dynamically allocate memory or have an object dynamically allocated locally in your function, you can use the scoped pointer. Scope from the local scope, so that an object of type scope pointer goes out of scope, the contained object will be deleted, which is nice because you don't have to remember it for all cases. If you have multiple exit points in your function, you don't have to remember. If you have if an exception is thrown in any of the called methods, you don't have to explicitly catch that exception and delete your local objects. Same applies for shared pointer and or meet pointer. That's for ref counting, for reference counting objects. If you have an object generated by a factory and you want to pass it around, pointer to that object around, and you want to make sure that when the last pointer to that object vanishes, the object is deleted, you can just wrap it into a shared pointer. Another nice tool is the service declaration helper. It's quite recent for UNO, if you need to for the UNO libraries, you need to, as I said, provide foreign C functions for registering and for actually generating the classes. And that's quite some boilerplate code, about 120 lines. You need to write down for every component implementation you provide. If you got a class that's a pimple already and you need to make it copy and write, there's also a copy and write wrapper that you can more or less just plug in. So you wrap that implementation pointer, that pimple pointer, in your handle class with that copy and write wrapper. Or RTL static, which wraps, that one emulates a static object, which only gets generated on demand, and in a thread safe way. And there are subtle issues with a so-called double check logging pattern that doesn't work on all machines, stuff like that, so it's nicely encapsulated in that template here. Okay, well, if you did all that, you still have bugs. Some misconceptions about GDB. This is specifically for you. in fact, I added it yesterday after the discussion. It pays off to use a recent versions. Usually they are quick and then fixing bugs, but you need to have a recent version, preferably from CDS. It pays off to change the compiler line with minus G, so build with the symbols. And with a minus G, GDB, both with symbols specifically tailored for GDB, so you tend to have less problems if you have that compile line switch.
Isn't it sufficient to change the C flags, the end
of
C flags?
Yeah, I've tried that, but I think the first one wins, and this is minus G. If you still have problems, for example, if you try to print a variable, then GDB tells you it's an incomplete type, and you're sure that your CXX file includes the header that defines that class, you might try this GCC options minus F emit class debug always, which makes sure that GDB doesn't filter out debug info for classes GDB thinks or GCC thinks are unnecessary for the object file. Especially if you want to debug UNO, it pays off to first run the office without GDB, trigger that functionality or use that functionality that you want to debug once, and then attach to the running office only after that one line, because GDB sometimes have trouble with demand loaded libraries, so you simply don't get symbols in that libraries if it's not already in process when GDB is attached. And also it's also hard to set the breakpoints and stuff that's not yet loaded, so that also helps. Yeah. Okay. Again, just a list of tools I found useful. Most of that is on the OpenOffice wiki. There's a category developer tools, which has a few pages which also contain most of those links. Yeah, of course, you need an editor, maybe you want to use an IDE like NetBeans or Eclipse, or the Microsoft Visual C++. If you want to do UML, Argo is a free UML editing tool for make the build experience easy. If you Emacs, both Emacs and VI have functionality to build within the editor and then skip or cycle through all errors directly in the code. There are wrappers for that for the OpenOffice build environment. Of course, unit testing or stripping down input files. So you got a big bug document that kind of crashes or does weird stuff, and you want to strip it down to contain exactly the pieces that trigger the error. So that's a tool, a way called delta debugging, which more or less tries to strip it down in a specific way. And that's also a tool that implements that, but just calls scripts, like, is it okay, is it okay, is it, oh, it's not okay, okay, then I found a bug, and then it tries another place, and leaves out other places from the encode and tries again. Code analysis, Doxygen is an source code documentation tool. Cscope is kind of an index. If you want to look up the definition of a class, you can index the source. Same with LXR, and Bonsai is a CVS front end. Both LXR and Bonsai are provided from the Go OO side. CPD, it's again your area of competence. It's a copy and paste detector, which scans the source code and points out places where code was copy and pasted, which is of course a bad thing because if you fix a bug at one place, you really need to fix it at all places. So it's on it's first the thing you should avoid, and if it's there, you need to find all places, but you can fix the bug in other places. Yeah, slot count I've already mentioned. That's just to get an impression how big the project is. Various source code parameters like GCC XML or Oink, which just does static code analysis or facilitates static code analysis. And so on. It would be way too much to introduce you to all of those tools. It's like, it's here, you can have a look if you're interested. It's also linked from the OpenOffice Wiki pages. Yeah. So there's also a list of recommended reading on the OpenOffice Wiki, with sections for C++, for Java, for general software engineering, which I also recommend if someone wants to seriously program in the OpenOffice core to check that out. Specific to that talk and that dependency issues, there's a book called Large Scale C++ Software Design, which basically addresses all those issues you encounter when you do very large C++ projects, like those physical dependencies and insulation and stuff like that. This book I've already shown you. This is C++ coding standards. Really worth reading because it represents contemporary knowledge about how things should be done in C++ today. Yeah, and then there's we plan for an update on the OpenOffice coding guidelines. I think until the end of the year there should be something. Okay. That's basically it. Any questions? Mike.
So can you get the Doxygen to run on the entire source code?
If not, we'll auto-dock you. If you have core memory, it will work, but...
How much is enough?
I don't know, 10 gig?
I don't have that much.
I'll
tried with VCF, it's very impressive.
The way I'm doing that is to generate a tag file for module-wise, and then include those tag files on a selective basis. Like if I want to generate slideshow documentation, I have a set of modules. I let run Doxygen in slideshow and include a set of specific tag files from other modules like Canvas or Base GFX. And the same for Rider. You would probably have SVX and SFX too, and maybe XML off on your list of included tag files.
Do you guys use Autodoc inside of Sun for API documentation?
Yes and no. We use it for UNO API, and we hardly use it for C++ documentation. Problem is that it's not always parsing every file correctly. But I think there's work on the way to get that up to par with Doxygen. But I won't recommend it right now for C++. Any further questions? So really, my take-home message here is there are mechanisms to get around that dependency help. They are also already used inside the code for quite some years. But it pays off to know about that, and if you've been bitten by that recompile overhead, maybe to change some more classes to use Pimple, or change some more classes to use UNO. So yes. It's work in progress.
Ah, Mike.
You win again.
I noticed that there are a jillion helper classes sort of strewn throughout the source code. Is there any list anywhere of all of the different helpers?
Yeah, I was planning to provide such a list. I think it was a half a year or so ago. Frank Schoenheit proposed to have a helper of the week kind of thread in a development mailing list, and it turned out that I think the decision was to move that to the wiki. There are already a few helpers described in the wiki. I think it's also linked from those developer tools category. Yeah, but you're right that tools an area that maybe needs some work. Again, I was trying to provide most of the information I gave here in the talk, also on the OpenOffice wiki. So nearly all those links are also on the wiki.
Thanks.
I don't know. Got it.
What's your favorite way of setting breakpoint in GDB? Do you set it by line number, or do you use the scope?
No, I don't. I usually use that backtick completion, which works if you have that, if you have all libs loaded.
Okay. Because it doesn't work often for me.
It sometimes doesn't work if you have nested templates, but then what should work? But for templates, another difficulty is that there's no one-on-one correspondence between line of code and point in the binary or address in the binary, because you have kind of multiple instantiation of the template. So yeah, well, templates are a problem. I tend to step through the template code once until I'm at the place, and then type break. So then I know it's exactly the place where the breakpoint hits. But otherwise, that for plain code, that backtick prefix of the name tab works for me. John?
I just wanted to ask you, a helper function in the O3TL namespace, is that a separate library?
That's not Not yet. Yeah, well, it's a separate module, and the scope of that module is to collect all helper functionality, which is pure, like does not need anything else or nearly nothing from the rest of the office. And the idea behind this is that it should contain potential candidates that might get upstreamed to, for example, Boost.
It was TL for tools or for template?
Template logger. Yeah.
Okay, so it has no library, it's just headers.
For now it's just headers,
yeah.
But it does not need to be only headers. For example, STL is also template lib, but still it is a link lib. Okay, Tim?
How do you view strings when debugging, because GDB doesn't understand what you think?
Ah, well, that's a question for Quaylen, I guess.
About GDB, I guess there is a. Well, the first thing is that deferred breakpoints work not a lot better with the file name and line URL. So, generally, if you just do GDB soffice.bin and you do your breakpoint on window.cxx with colon line URL, that'll generally work an awful lot better than breaking on a symbol. The deferred breakpoints work better in that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing then is on the printing out strings. We did add some helper methods to tools and cell that can print, that can return back an ordinary character string UTF-8 representation of all various individual string classes. And GDB in theory can call a function from the library that it's debugging at the time. So in theory, if you are in GDB, you should be able to just do call debug underscore dump string, and it will appropriately look up the appropriately named overridden C++ function for that string. That worked about 2 years ago. That worked fine out of the box. About 1 year ago, it broke in GDB. But about 2 weeks ago, I got a notification on the bug that they fixed that problem in GDB again. So again, if you get the very latest GDB down from CVS, you should be back to where we were with a very nice solution, which is that you just type in or make a little small script, GDB script alias, to call this debug underscore dump on the function name. But I haven't tried it myself since they fixed it. We may need to modify some of the new visibility stuff to get that function again. But at the moment, there isn't any good solution, but there was, and there hopefully will be good.
Yeah, but that's the way to do that kind of stuff in GDB, like add debug output methods to all classes of interest.
That's right.
Is it included in all builds or only in a debug build?
It was originally, yes, it's supposed to be included in all builds, and it's compiled with that particular file. It's always compiled with a always debug option on. So
yeah.
When everything else is stripped and everything else is not debugged, the two files that exist for the ordinary Unicode string and for the cell Unicode string and non-Unicode variants, they should still be debugged, so if nothing else works, you should be able to call it easily. So in theory, if all the underpinning is there, GDB just lost the ability to do it for a year. Hopefully it's back again. We need to revisit it.
Excellent. Anybody else? No. I think it's exactly on time. Thanks for listening.